You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. This week we turn our attention to Central Europe, a region with a tumultuous history that is still very much influencing higher education development today. We're seeing populist politics threatening academic freedom and serious brain drain of scholars leaving the region for better funded institutions further afield. But universities in the region are also highly ambitious and are eager to become hubs for quality world-class research. We'll be talking about this as well. I'm Sarah Custer, and joining me today is Tim Swula, who is head of content engagement for our World Summit series. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Sarah.
Thanks for coming today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
I also spoke earlier with our European reporter, David Matthews, about the issues he's following in Central Europe. But first, Tim, we're hosting our Research Excellence Summer in the Czech Republic next week, April 24th to the 26th. Can you tell me a little bit about why you decided to host this specific event in Central Europe this year?
Sure. I mean, the research excellence strand of our World Summit series kind of portfolio really enables us to kind of have a deeper focus, usually from a regional perspective, around the kind of the strategies that can create, you know, improve research output, you know, improve research impact. And, you know, we know, we hear it all the time from the people who we speak to around the world. This is something they'd like to explore. So it gives us an opportunity to sort of really spend 72 hours together with leaders from around a region discussing those kinds of issues. And in terms of Central Europe, I suppose, you know, we found that, you know, in terms of the focus of the magazine, you know, what gets a lot of interest, you know, we spend a lot of time looking at, you know, the outstanding universities around Western Europe. And, you know, we've had more increasing feedback that, you know, we need to be looking more a bit further east and around Central Europe. And I mean, the summit itself is actually called New Europe. So it's looking at those 13 member states of the European Union that have acceded since 2004. Because within that region, there's obviously a fantastic heritage of higher education. There's some amazing, you know, distinctive universities that have been around for hundreds of years. But I suppose in the way that universities have grown and developed and expanded and internationalized over the last sort of 30, 40, 50 years or so, there's been, you know, fantastic progress made around the kind of the clusters of higher education excellence where we know in the UK, US, you know, the East Asian Pacific Rim, for example, and that Central European region is perhaps feels a bit left behind. And so when we had our Emerging Economies Summit back in Africa, in Johannesburg in 2017, you know, several people from the Central Europe region said, you know, we need to have a conversation focusing on where we are. Because in terms of the economies, they were saying that, you know, they're often not eligible, you know, they're not receiving kind of OECD aid or anything like that. So they're not seen as a kind of developing economy in that sense. But equally, they're not positioned as perhaps kind of these advanced higher education nations. And so they kind of get overlooked in terms of internationalization strategies from the top institutions in our rankings or others. So that's why we wanted to have a focus. And then in terms of the Czech Republic, I mean, it's 2018, it's 100 years since the founding of the modern state Czechoslovakia. It's 50 years since the Prague Spring. It's 25 years since the, they call it the Velvet Separation, you know, the Czech and the Slovak Republics coming out. So it seems like a perfect time to be there. And Olomouc in the sort of the ancient capital of the Moravia region, you know, will be a fabulous place to be.
Great. Just for our listeners who might not be familiar with exactly which countries are included in this, can you give us a list of what those countries are?
Yep. So the New Europe region, as we are describing it, includes Bulgaria, Croatia, Cyprus, Czech Republic, Estonia, Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, Malta, Poland, Romania, Slovakia, and of course, Slovenia.
Plenty of things going on there. And our man on the ground, David Matthews, who's based in Berlin, covers Europe for Times Higher Education. And I had a chat with him earlier this week about some of the issues that he's covering, how the Iron Curtain divide is still playing out today in higher education, and how concerned university leaders are about rising nationalism in the region. Hi, David.
Hi.
How's Berlin?
Yeah, great, thanks. Yeah, we've exited what seemed like the longest winter ever, so it's now, you know, mid-20s here, so it's very nice.
Great.
London hitting that that high?
Today it is. I can't imagine that your winter was any longer than our winter, though, so you won't get much sympathy from me.
Okay. I'm sure it's more brutal. But
so you're doing a really good job of covering Europe for TAT, but I wanted to talk to you specifically today about things that you're looking at within the Central European region, like what kind of big themes you're following as you're covering the continent.
I mean, there's quite a lot going on in Central and Eastern Europe at the moment. But I guess rather like North America and Western Europe, I mean, politics and more specifically kind of populism and new political forces seems to be driving things. A lot of the stories I'm writing about are, you know, politician X comes to power and or consolidates power and wants to do something that universities don't like. Mm-hmm. Hungary is probably the biggest story in Central and Eastern Europe I've covered the past year. I mean, last summer I was in Budapest covering the Central European University saga, which, a quick recap, mm-hmm. there's an amendment to the law that the CEU says will force it out of the country. Viktor Orban, who's Hungary's quite authoritarian, sort of anti-liberal, anti-refugee prime minister, basically has launched this rhetorical war against George Soros, the American-Hungarian financier who's basically founded and parts funded the CEU, which sees itself as a kind of liberal bastion post the communist period. And now we've recently had an election in Hungary. Viktor Orban won very comfortably. I think roughly two-thirds of seats went to his party, Fidesz. So now the CEU is kind of in limbo, basically. We don't know what's going to happen to it. I suppose there's two schools of thought. This huge thumping victory allows Orban to press ahead with closing it down, which would mm-hmm. be very sad. I mean, they'll probably move to Vienna because they've said that they're going to establish a kind of branch campus in Vienna. On the other hand, we will see, but the more optimistic view is Orban is now secure in his power. He doesn't need the CEU as a scapegoat anymore. And to be honest, I mean, the CEU didn't really feature in Hungary's election campaign. It was always very anti-refugee, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, basically. And I don't know whether it was particularly popular, this move against the CEU in Hungary, but it certainly didn't stop Fidesz winning a huge majority. Mm. I mean, there's this one strike against the CEU in Hungary by Orban. But there's a kind of wider theme in Hungary and across Eastern Europe, which is a sort of, I guess, a kind of utilitarian shading into kind of anti-university turn, potentially. I mean, so Orban, I mean, he obviously doesn't like the CEU, but he's basically that guy in the kind of bore in the pub, as I've put it in the past, who, you know, rails against, there's too many students going to university. They just sort of sit around and drink all the time. You know, we need more mechanics and so on. In the Czech Republic, the ANO party, which is a new party that, you know, like in so many countries, has swept aside the existing conservative and social democrat parties. I think they're in a minority government at the moment, so they probably won't be able to push anything through. But their platform was also very kind of utilitarian. You know, we want Czech research to serve the economy. We need people to, you know, we need to make sure that graduates have the skills they need for the market. Then again, in Western Europe, this is happening as well. I mean, in the UK, you've got politicians trying to rank university courses by graduate salaries. Mm-hmm. Denmark as well, you know, some reform. People think, well, further cut back the humanities, but this is a sort of common thing, it seems, but it's particularly concentrated in Hungary, where the, you know, if you speak to people in humanities and law faculties, they say they've suffered big cuts.
You've mentioned in your pieces how it kind of goes against this goal that institutions in the West have and countries in the West to be knowledge economies. Do you feel like there's a desire to create those knowledge economies within those countries?
Difficult to generalize. I mean, Hungary, they seem, the critics of Orbán, at least anyway, he's sort of given up on this idea that Hungary will follow the same path as other countries and, well, sort of Western European countries and end up, you know, Hungarians being, you know, international lawyers, and basically thinks, well, Hungary is a sort of slightly poorer economy that will just do best by, you know, making German cars, basically. I mean, that's probably quite a cynical view.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they have rejigged their university system and do seem to really question whether you need that many people doing a kind of non-vocational higher education, basically. I mean, on one hand, this is sort of fair enough. There are lots of governments across the world questioning whether their investments, as they see it, in higher education, in non-vocational higher education, should pay off. I mean, I was in Switzerland a few weeks ago, where not very many people, and just over a quarter of youngsters, do theoretical higher education or non-vocational higher education. And, you know, it's an incredibly rich, incredibly healthy country. Right?
Mm.
So there's a, but you know that the lots of the rhetoric in Hungary and elsewhere is more, I think it ties into the kind of political splits we've seen in Europe and North America as well. It's almost sort of the revenge of people who didn't go to university and do often think, oh, too many people go to university, why is our money being wasted on this kind of thing? It's hinged with a kind of utilitarianism, with a sort of anti-intellectualism, particularly in Orbán's case. So I think universities might be quite vulnerable because they're at the end, on the end of a kind of political backlash against, you know, being too liberal and so on. But also it's a point where the economic rationale for further expansion is being seriously questioned.
Another thing that you've touched on has been the question of academic freedom, and that was certainly how CEU's leadership, Michael Ignatieff specifically, has framed the attack on CEU as it's an attack on academic freedom. And you've talked a little bit about some similar reactions to policies in Poland.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's the CEU thing. I mean, yes, I'd to be clear, I definitely agree. It is an attack on academic freedom. It's an attack on the university. It's an attack on it as a political point of opposition. It's, you know, it's not primarily about, well, maybe people should be mechanics instead.
Mm-hmm.
So in Poland, yes, there's been great concern from some Polish historians, an amendment to the law defining what can be said about the Polish nation and states, I believe that's the phrase used in the law, what can be said about a role in the Holocaust, basically. So it could become a criminal offence to say that the Polish national state was responsible for the Holocaust. Now, there is an academic exception to this, but lots of academics think this is very vague. The law is very vaguely drafted. And, you know, where does academic work stop? And, you know, if you write a newspaper column as an academic, are you still covered by the exception? Or will you, you know, could you be criminally prosecuted? The background to this in Poland is that, you know, for reasonable reasons, I think, is that, you know, people are very, very touchy or offended when people use the phrase Polish death camps to describe Auschwitz and so on. I mean, clearly they're in Poland, but you cannot hold Poland responsible for them in the same sense. I mean, I believe Barack Obama apologized a few years ago for using that phrase. However, this law is, most historians see, as a massive overreaction, a kind of attempt to silence those Polish historians who have done lots of work over the past 15 years on, you know, basically the collaboration of some Poles in, you know, the persecution of Jews during that period. It's also important to know it's not just about the Holocaust. It's also about massacres of Ukrainian partisans, I believe, during the Second World War.
Right.
So it's all basically an attempt to try and restrict what can be said about Poland and Polish people, what they did during the Second World War, which obviously was a period of incredible suffering for Poland, but the academic critics fear this is a sort of, you know, a slightly cynical move by the authoritarian-ish ruling Law and Justice Party to basically say, we're defending Poland's good name. How dare you, you know, besmirch our history, basically. Mm. But they think it will have an effect on what people can say and publish and do.
There's a history to all of this, which you talk about in your feature, your upcoming feature for the magazine, which really kind of delves into the two paths that diverge between East Germany and Poland and how they're in such separate places, but they both began in very similar paths. Can you give us a little preview about what you talk about in that piece?
Yeah, the background to what I've been saying is, you know, there is still this divide between East and Western Europe, or I should say a divide between, you know, former communist and capitalist Europe. You can see it on a map when you plot the proportion of highly cited articles, things like that. It's basically the East of the continent has not really caught up with the West in terms of its research prowess and its university rankings and so on, in quite the same way that economies have. I mean, lots of, you know, the Czech Republic is, you know, has a pretty high per capita income, almost the EU average, I believe. Poland's growing very strongly, but still we don't really see universities from that region breaking through in our rankings or in other things like European Research Council grant tables and so on. And yeah, so in this feature, I'm sort of trying to shed some light on this by looking at what's happened basically since the fall of the Iron Curtain, the fall of communist regimes, and how specifically Poland and East Germany rebuilt their science systems after 1989. And, you know, in theory, if East Germany was its own country, I suspect it would probably be doing about as well as Poland at the moment. But basically because it was subsumed into West Germany, it's now very much a kind of Western, very good system. It's, you know, wins lots of money, lots of highly cited articles and so on. It's got some decently ranked universities like Humboldt in Berlin. But what was required was basically lots of East German professors were basically fired and replaced with West German ones. There was a huge injection of money from West Germany as well. And you also had kind of institutions like Max Planck setting up institutions in East Germany, sort of moving from West to East. And this hasn't really happened in Poland or elsewhere in the region. Generally, these countries still have kind of academies of science, so sort of separate research institution networks that are separate from universities. But more broadly, there's this issue that these countries can catch up by attracting, you know, German car manufacturers to build factories there because the wages are low, for example. Mm-hmm. But if you don't pay your scientists very well, they'll just leave. So there's this sort of disjointed developments in Eastern Europe where the economies have done very well, at least in the last decade since joining the EU anyway. But in terms of research, it's not really broken through in the way people would hope. I mean, that's quite worrying given the sort of populist, some of the populist policies towards universities. You know, you can imagine some of the very, very powerful established universities resisting that kind of thing in the West, but in the East of the continent, they may not have the strength if things get rather worse for them to sort of to resist any kind of political onslaught.
And I think it's easy to forget that this is quite recent history. I mean, 1989, a lot of people who are still working in universities in Central and Eastern Europe were probably still around whenever communism was the ruling government. So what's been their response to this rise of more populist political parties in the past few years? Are they worried about it, or is it just kind of like, look, we've lived far worse before, we can totally weather this storm?
I mean, so if you talk to some people on, you know, on records in universities, they say, you know, we have developed enough of a voice in society to resist any clamp down on academic freedom in the future. And to be fair, I mean, you know, this may be a passing phase. It may get better. There's no reason necessarily why things necessarily will get worse over the next decade or so. But then I don't think people take the view that, oh, well, we've ridden out this before, it'll be fine, because, you know, the communist period was that there were elements of excellent mass, particularly, I think, in Russia and Soviet-linked states. But generally, it left the universities and science systems in a pretty weak state. I mean, when people say, oh, it's happening again, they're not saying, oh, we've ridden out before, but they're saying, this is really worrying and bad. I mean, in Hungary, for example, you know, I spoke to a researcher who was very nervous about the future, and he saw the return of some things he recognized under the communist system, which were, under the communist system, apparently you had, in your research grant applications, you had to write what was called a red tail, which was sort of a kind of, at the end of your proposal, you would have to say, oh, well, this contributes to the development of socialism because of X, Y, Z. And now he sort of sees a similar thing in Hungary, where you feel compelled to write out why your research is in some way good for the government priorities now. The thing is, it's often difficult to know what part of this is political control and what is it? Is it just a general greater demand for academics to have economic impact, which we've seen in the UK, as well as budgets are tight and governments don't know how to get the economy going again. So there is that caveat. But
right.
I don't think people are sort of saying, oh, we've weathered this before, it'll be fine. I think they're quite worried, some of them.
Can I ask you about a very fun topic, Brexit?
Oh, great. Yes. Of course.
Does it come up at all whenever you're having conversations with people over there? I mean, do they see it as an opportunity to try to kind of move in to the vacuum that the UK might leave?
Well, it depends who you're talking to. I mean, for Europeans more broadly, in Germany particularly, I mean, I think they like to appear publicly very sort of sad about it and not say, oh, this is going to be a great opportunity. But I think, you know, the reports you read and off record, people are sort of trying to poach people from the UK. I mean, some of them see it as an opportunity. For Central and Eastern Europe, more broadly, I think Brexit might be an opportunity to change the way European funding is distributed, because at the moment European funding normally, I mean, most of the European budget goes obviously on agriculture, but then there's also a big chunk goes to the poorer bits of the continent. It's basically redistributive. But science funding works the other way, weirdly, in that it goes to whoever's best, so through the European Research Council, and therefore the UK does incredibly well, places like the Netherlands. Basically, rich countries with good science systems already do very well, and Eastern Europe gets scraps, basically. They hardly win anything. And it's possible that with the UK going, a big voice for this current system will leave, and they might reorientate FP9, which would be the successor to Horizon 2020, away from that. Because I think there's a sense that you would have hoped by now Eastern Europe would win more European funds through this sort of excellence mechanism, but it's not really happening. One other point about Brexit, I mean, is international students.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the really big issues in Eastern Europe at the moment is there's a demographic crisis, which is enormous. I mean, I think in Poland, since about 2005 or so, the number of students has dropped by about a third. It's a real collapse in numbers, because there just aren't the sort of local young people to come through into the university system. It might be an opportunity for some Eastern European countries to attract people who would have gone to the UK otherwise, but I don't, without it, them being sort of English language environments, I don't think that's very likely. I mean, the Czech Republic has done things like offered free higher education for foreign students as long as they do it in Czech.
Right.
Which has been quite successful, I think.
Has it?
Yeah. Well, I suppose, yeah, exactly. It's not, you're not going to come from China to do that. You might come from Russia to do that, or a neighboring country, or Slovakia, certainly. But the language, the lack of reputation to the national standings of these universities, and then the sort of the job markets afterwards, I think it's going to be difficult for them to build a kind of global intake. I mean, regional, possibly, yes. But I think they'll struggle to do that. And yeah, they're kind of running out of their own youngsters to recruit, because you can only increase the university participation rate so far. But I should say that, you know, a lot of universities in the region do have, you know, grand plans. There's lots of exciting collaborations across Europe going on with new European university ideas that Macron has been talking about. Warsaw has lots of plans to win new ERC research grants. To be fair to some of the parties, the sort of in quotes populist parties, I mean, not all of their ideas are bad. I mean, the ANO in the Czech Republic wants far more, much more circulation of students internationally. So it's not all bad for universities, I don't think. I think it's just they're worried about how they're perceived by the voters and politicians of these new parties, perhaps.
That was David Matthews, our European reporter. So this summit is looking at research excellence specifically. How is the event in Olomouc next week going to tackle the topic? Can you tell us some of the highlights from the program, Tim?
So the program really began with me going over and spending some time with the rector and vice-rector of Polatsky University about a year ago, and trying to get his perspective. And then, you know, we obviously do research and talk to a few other people about the region. But, you know, he wanted it to be a fairly instructional summit with lots of practical examples. And although, you know, we're calling it the New Europe Summit, obviously we want to include perspectives from outside of the European region as well, as, you know, some of the speakers from the big European nations. Some of the sessions are based very much around kind of research and reputation, and, you know, whether it's possible even really for New Europe to define itself as to something distinct from the other EU member states, and, you know, what do universities in that region need to do to kind of reclaim their reputations away from these, you know, amazing, you know, Baroque heritage institutions and as, you know, thriving, dynamic, you know, forward-looking universities. And we've actually got a keynote speech from Sir Anton Muscatelli, the president and principal of University of Glasgow, talking about, you know, Glasgow's role within the Scottish higher education network and how it, you know, clearly has an enormous global reputation as well. So there's sessions, you know, looking at that kind of reputation and branding perspective, and then we've got sessions looking at, you know, establishing partnerships between new Europe and the rest of the world, and trying to ask the question about, you know, what does the, you know, the world outside Europe, you know, think about that whole new Europe region, and what are they looking for in partners, you know, what would attract them specifically against you know, the opportunities that are obviously there from universities in the Netherlands, for example, or the UK or Germany. And then, you know, we've got a great keynote speech, I think, from the Vice President of the European Parliament, a Czech called Pavel Telička. We'll be talking about the European education area and the post-Horizon 2020 frameworks that are coming up, and how, you know, that can better integrate universities in that central and eastern and southern European region of the EU, and what the kind of the attitude of Brussels is towards that region, how much importance they place on higher education as a mechanism of, you know, driving growth. And then, you know, we'll have another discussion where we're bringing in Roland Chin, who's the president of Hong Kong Baptist University, and Yuko Hariyama, who's recently retired as an executive member from the Japanese government's Council for Science and Technology Policy. So, you know, trying to get that perspective from East Asia as well about, you know, what the systems are there that work within Hong Kong and Japan, but equally, you know, what kind of impetus there might be and interest there is from the universities there in linking up with Central Europe. And then, you know, the next day of the summit, we've also and this isn't particularly about research excellence, but we couldn't have a discussion in Central Europe and not talk about the issues of populism. Clearly in electoral politics, you know, over the last year, that's become even more relevant, even more topical, and clearly, you know, the pressure that Central Europe University has experienced in Hungary is massive, and Rector Miller himself is an alumnus of CEU, so he really personally wanted to have some kind of focus there. So we've got the provost of CEU coming and talking about that. We've also got John Connolly, who's coming over from Berkeley in California. He runs the Eastern European Studies Department there, so he'll be giving a slightly more historical perspective on the region and populism there as it's been over the last century. So that's going to be a big discussion that I'm sure will be really passionate.
Yeah.
And then lastly, the summit's closing with, again, a bit more of a practical discussion around kind of alliances and forming new alliances, whether that kind of, you know, what the existing networks can and do offer European universities in Central Europe, you know, whether they feel marginalized from the big groups, you know, whether it be LERU, for example, or even, you know, Universitas 21 or something like that that's completely international. And so it's that kind of mixture of, you know, sort of the practical, the more theoretical, and, you know, the hopes for the future of what people are really aspiring to that I think is going to make this summit most interesting.
Great. An all-star cast, as always.
We have
an all-star global cast. Jan Palmowski, who is the Secretary General of the Guild of Research Intensive Universities, is also going to be sitting on a panel at the summit. And I had a chance to speak with him to get his take on the specific challenges Central European researchers face to secure funding European research programs like Horizon 2020, as well as establish cross-border collaborations. He also talks to me a little bit about what he's hoping he'll take away from next week's summit.
Could you just start off talking a little bit about the research and innovation gap that you've seen across Europe?
So the statistics are fairly clear in that around the share of EU-13 participation in Horizon 2020 is around 4.5%. And that compares to the share of EU-15 countries, which is at close to 90%. And so what has happened is that in Horizon 2020, as the third country participation has declined, it's really the EU-15 states that have benefited from that. So in other words, the growing the growing nature of Horizon 2020, the increased budget and so forth vis-a-vis FP7 has really benefited the EU 15, and within that, it's really benefited the sort of closed clubs, you know, the top performers of research institutions. So if you look at the top 100 research organizations that benefit from H 2020, not a single one of them is from the EU 13 states.
And why do you think that is?
So that has a large number of very complex reasons. I mean, so there are some cultural issues in many of the member states, not all of them, because you know, changing your academic system, your academic cultures takes time. And you need to do this in collaboration with researchers from all over the world. So you can't just do it in an enclosed way within your own national systems. You need to change your national laws around this. Culture, I would say, is a very important part. The second important point is structural. We have seen a number of reforms in the past and in present that are undertaken in order to try and create some of the conditions that create a focus on excellence. So to give you one example, Estonia started this process very early. So right after independence, they created very stark reforms to push institutional autonomy and for competitive research funding. They were quite unusual at the time, and we see the results now in a real relative success of that academic system. By contrast, Poland is only pushing through a very large-scale reform of the academic system and governance structures right now, this year. So there are different countries on different timetables, but there are structural factors. But finally, there are also economic factors, frankly. So salaries in these countries are low. It's very hard for them to attract international researchers, and that makes collaboration that much harder.
Mm. Yeah, that was that's a topic I've come across quite a bit whenever I'm discussing this region, is the reality of brain drain.
Mm-hmm.
How can they go about combating that?
So it's interesting to look at the ERC's figures, for instance, on this. So that's half of the Polish recipients on Polish ERC recipients are outside Poland. And there are some countries where there are more people outside those countries than inside that receive ERC grants. So that's just a nice illustration of the problem that you're talking about. I think the issue is not just financial. There are also very often capacity issues. So the capacity of some of those countries to provide the appropriate infrastructures and the sort of appropriate research ecosystems for these researchers to be happy, to be comfortable and to be excellent at what they do. This is not just whilst they're holding these grants and whilst they're being funded, but also afterwards when they return. Finally, there is a question I think one needs to raise about implicit bias. So there are a number of, I hear a lot of stories from researchers who have returned back to their countries of origin, only to find they find it much harder for their research grant applications to be successful. And there's a very strong sense that this is because of the addresses where they're applying from. It's very hard to really make that stick or to know to what extent that really is a factor. But because we don't know, it's a point that we have to take seriously, I think.
If that bias does exist, what would be that bias? Just preconceptions of the quality of research coming from there, or the type of academic?
It's preconceptions about the quality of research. I mean, as the ERC statistics shows, that there are outstanding academics from any and every nationality here in Europe. But we just really need to make sure that we don't disadvantage people who apply from certain institutions that we've never heard of. If they have excellent infrastructures around them, and if they succeed where they are, we should take their research as face value. And as I said, I'm not saying that this definitely is a problem, but what I'm saying is that we don't really know the extent to which this is a problem or not, and I think that we owe it to ourselves to assure ourselves that it's not an issue.
One of the things you haven't really mentioned yet is politics of the region. Do you think that comes into play in their ability to kind of create these cross-border collaborations and receive funding?
Yeah, so to be fair, I did mention this in the structural factors,
okay.
where I was talking about the different national systems and the different laws. So I think this is a really, really important issue. And one of the most important issues within that is that of funding, right? So a number of countries spend well under 1% of GDP on research and innovation, and that's just too low. So really, overall spending and the overall ambition of these systems, really of many of these countries, needs to go up. Now, this is a blanket statement, and you can't, in truth, generalize. So there are a number of countries, just some smaller countries within the EU-13 that spend a good amount on GDP. So Slovenia, for instance, spends above the EU average at just over 2% on GDP on research and innovation. But there are many countries like Poland that spends just under 1%. I think Romania and Bulgaria spend well under 1% of GDP on research and innovation. And that is an issue because it does hinder the capacity, of course, of their research systems to catch up.
And how much do you think political parties have sway in that, in terms of prioritizing funding for research? If we're looking at specific policies that have been passed in Hungary or Poland that seem to be kind of attacking the academy as the state that it's in, how much are you concerned about that? Is that something that comes up in your discussions?
Oh, it's a huge concern. And the European University Association only issued a call, I think, 2 days ago, again, outlining its very strong concerns about academic freedom in Hungary. It's not clear to me that academic freedom is threatened in Poland, and I think the reforms that the government is pushing through there doesn't, I think, raise those kinds of concerns. But I think in Hungary, that is a different issue, and I personally would support the EUA statement fully, and it's also been endorsed by other rectors' conferences, for instance, the German rectors' conference.
What about Brexit? How do you think this is going to impact research in the region? Is that going to kind of make room for some smaller institutions to get a piece of the pie, or is it going to have maybe a more negative effect?
I simply do not see any positive effect that can come out of Brexit, out of a separation, out of any greater separation of researchers between the UK and the EU. I just don't see any scenario in which that can have any positive effects. Because we thrive on the intensity of collaboration, on the freedom of the exchange of ideas, and the movement of researchers and students. And any detriment to that has to be bad news for researchers everywhere. I would add that when we speak to some of our own members in who are in EU 13 countries, for instance, at Tartu or Ljubljana, and Krakow and Younger Union, many of them point out the help and support they've received from UK academics, from UK bodies like the Wellcome Trust, in getting research grants, in through research collaborations. So I think in very practical ways, many of my colleagues are concerned about any impediments to these kinds of collaborations in the future.
Looking to the future, what are some of the challenges that you think that European strategists should focus on whenever they're sitting in Brussels?
Yesterday, Jean-Pierre Bourguignon, the president of the ERC, gave an important speech in Berlin. In that speech, he raised a concern that we absolutely share, which is that there is a concern that national leaders and the EU might be too directive in their research policies. He strongly supported the notion that researchers and innovators needed to be entrusted with leading on solutions for the future. And so I think that in the future, we really need to get right an ecosystem between top-down and bottom-up approaches on research support. And it's really important that we get that balance right and that not one side gets too much attention. And I think that getting that balance right, I think, is extremely important for us all, irrespective of where in Europe we are.
Jan, you're going to Palaki next week for the THE Summit on Research in Olomouc at Palaki University. What are you looking forward to? What are you hoping to walk away with?
So I think what I hope we all will walk away with is, first of all, a much greater sense of differentiation. We very often think of sort of Eastern Europe or EU 13, and there are these are the sort of easy labels to kind of describe the problem, and I've done this in our conversation. But actually, the problems of these countries are very varied, very diverse, and I think getting a better understanding of the diversity of the issues within that region is the first thing that I hope we will walk away with. The second thing is that I hope is that we will get a much better understanding together of the commonalities that we have, the common issues that we face and the common challenges, but also the common opportunities. Because in the end, I think actually the similarities and the commitment to research excellence, the common understanding of what of open science and the need for open science and for openness and for involving citizens, there are so many agendas that we share. And I think that in thinking about the problem of the innovation and research gap, it's very, very easy to look at the many more things that unite us, that actually hold us together and that we need to build on.
And that was Jan Palmowski, Secretary General of the Guild of Research Intensive Universities. I also had a chat with Jaroslav Miller, who is rector of Palaki University, in the days leading up to the summit, about how preparations are going, what he's looking forward to in the event, and to hear some of his opinions about some of those themes we talked about that will be discussed, like populism in the region and brain drain.
How are preparations going for the summit?
Well, I would say that everything is ready. Yeah, of course, there are some minor issues to be solved, but for 99%, we are ready. Yeah, just waiting for the guests and speakers.
And what are you looking forward to over the 3 days? What are you hoping to
establish? Well, I'm really looking forward to two panels on political protectionism, and of course I'm looking forward to our final future-oriented panel, if I may say so, on Central Europe in 2028. But personally, well, I very much hope that new strategic partnerships perhaps might be discussed in the course of the summit, and I would like to debate also the creation of the platform for the closer collaboration between academies in Central Europe and the European West, and of course non-European universities as well. So we'll see. We'll see. But these are my personal expectations, to be honest.
Can we talk a little bit about the political populism that you mentioned? And there's a panel on it at the summit. The last time we spoke was in, I think, end of last year, and things have changed quite a bit in the region since then. So how are you feeling about the impact that this could have on higher education in Central Europe?
Well, this is a very complex issue, actually. Yeah, I mean that in principle, of course, politics can be instrumental in supporting this institutionalized research in many ways. Yeah, but of course, the impact might be also negative, as rising populism across Europe in general and across Central Europe in particular is always at odds with the critical thinking and the science-based academic training at universities. But at the same time, probably with the exception of Hungary and this infamous case of Central European University, but in general, I don't think that the academic freedom is at risk these days in Central Europe. Yeah? Of course, the situation may change in the course of time, but currently, I don't think that the academic freedom might be endangered. This is my own personal feeling.
Another topic that people have talked about around excellence in the region is the risk of brain drain. Is this something that within your own institution at Palaki, is this something that you're actively trying to combat?
That's a great point. Yeah, there are several. Well, according to OECD statistics, there are several Central European countries, typically Estonia, but also Czech Republic, that succeeded in reversing the brain drain. So from approximately 2006 or 2007, there is a net brain gain. Yeah. So we are able to attract more researchers and scientists and scholars from abroad. Of course, until now, there are some countries that really face brain drain, which is the case of mostly Balkan countries. Yeah. But picking for the Czech Republic, we really reverse the brain drain and turn it into brain gain. So currently, this is not the major problem.
How did you do that? How did you reverse the brain drain?
Well, first of all, of course, we have massively invested into a research infrastructure. So currently, we might have arguably the most modern research infrastructure in Europe. And of course, this attracts people. Yeah. And second, our national budget for research combined with the European money make Central Europe a relatively attractive region in terms of funding. So these are probably two reasons beyond the brain gain, beyond this reversion from brain drain to brain gain, in my view at least.
And what are some of the challenges as you're looking towards the future? What are the big challenges that you're going to tackle, do you think?
Well, again, that's my personal feeling. Yeah. What Central European research badly needs, among other things, is a much higher success rate of grant applications for European funding. Yeah. For instance, the ERC grants. ERC projects. The percentage of our success rate is strikingly low. So we simply have to be much more active and we have to be much more successful. And this is definitely an issue to be discussed in the course of the summit. And to achieve this goal, to increase our success rate, we need more international partnerships. We need more strategic partnership. We have to be more active in international consortia, etc. Of course, there is an entire spectrum of ways how to achieve this goal. Yeah, and personally, I I expect that this issue is going to be discussed in the summit.
And that was Jaroslav Miller, rector of Palaki University, the host of next week's Times Higher Education Research Excellence Summit. I think that's all we've got time for today. Tim, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.
If you've got questions or comment for the podcast, please do get in touch at sarah.custer@timeshighereducation.com. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.